You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plans Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
Welcome, listeners. This particular edition of Spirit World Restless is devoted to the amazing poet Martina Rees Newbury. Martina has just released her latest book of poems called Glyphs, another treasure chest of gems that I hope you'll all enjoy. And in this show, you'll be hearing an interview that she was kind enough to allow me to do with her. You'll be hearing her read from her most favorite selections of her book. And in addition, you'll hear other poets who adore Martina and wished to pay homage to this amazing woman by selecting their favorite poems from Glyphs. Now, these poets all gather together under the auspices of Raymond Soulard Jr. and his online magazine called The Cenacle. And together we wished to honor Martina. The last time I did an interview with Martina, the last time you heard Spirit World Restless deal with Martina's talent was back in 2010. And at that point, we were talking about her other books, including After the Earthquake and Late Night Radio and What We Can't Forgive and Perhaps You Could Breathe For Me. She's written so many books. Each one is an amazing. Each one is an honor to read because each one pinpoints the times which seem to span no matter what's going on around us. Martina's voice is always focused right on the inner node of what has to be heard. She's brave. She's courageous. She's amazing. And so I'm so happy to present this show. I adore it, and I hope you do too. So without further ado, let's get on with it, and I hope you enjoy it. I am overjoyed to be speaking with my dear friend,
Martina.
And Martina, welcome to this opportunity to talk.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's rare that you meet somebody online that you've never met in person and you just love them so much. It's like they're right there in your heart all the time, and that's how I feel about you.
I know. At the beginning, I was sure I would like just toss over and hug you for real. I was sure I'd find myself in your house, and it was so obvious to me. And it hasn't happened.
I wish that so much. And I do love you. And I'm so glad to be talking to you. I wouldn't care what we were talking about. It's just good to be talking to you.
Yeah, but I get to pump your brain. So that's even more amazing.
Okay. Pump away.
I'm going to pump. So I'm going to begin with the question that I began with when I wrote you, even though times have changed since then. So I'll just start with what everyone's talking about. Everyone's talking about these uncertain times. And it's as if once upon a time, times were certain. You know, it's so ridiculous. Suddenly things are uncertain. Like, wake up, people. Anyway, I wanted to know, if, because of the times that we're going through and being reclusive a little bit more because of the pandemic, do you find yourself going back to prior times? Memories, nostalgia, do you find yourself looking back into prior moments and looking at old poems that you wrote and maybe feeling that something you said once upon a time is relevant now? Is there such a piece, or is there a poem, or do you want to talk about that?
Sure. There's a poem from one of my early books that seems to reflect what I am at just about any given time, certainly in my adult life. And it's from the book Learning by Rote. It's called The World Is Not Ending. The world is not ending. Let me get my bearings. These are spaces I will never own. I feel such regret, especially now that the world is on fire. The air is eaten by flame all around. Monks with their skirts billowing jump from the mountaintops, chant poverty, chastity, indifference. laughing in the face of this molten planet. Laugh your ass off. It's what you'll have left in the end. You think this is an hallucination? A joke? A fantasy? Perhaps you're bewildered. The world is not ending. You've only backed one last war, one last steaming Holocaust. You've only stayed silent while continents starved and died, whittled down to rock and bleached bone. Is your own part in this unlikely or misunderstood? Mine, unfortunately, is not. I've participated and want to move on. Just give me a moment, please. Just let me get my bearings.
Yeah.
I think it seems like I have, and I'm sure to you, it seems like I have spent my whole adult life just getting my bearings.
Yeah, well, the whole world is falling apart. The cracks.
Yeah.
Cracking open.
Yeah, and even.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you think, you know, I'm 78 now, but it seems like since I've been maybe a teenager, there's just been one thing after another saying, you know, watch out, be careful, here it comes, oh no, you know, and it's like you wonder after all these years, is there ever going to be a time that you wake up in the morning and say, nothing is wrong, nothing is wrong? And I just wonder if that's universally something that's just not going to happen ever, or I don't know.
Well, as I age, I do more and more meditation, and I stay more and more away from the news. And when I wake up in the morning, unless I'm hearing a siren alert outside, I detach. And so when I wake in the morning, I'm filled with joy. I know there's coffee in my future and exercise and a walk. So I'm doing what I can to detach. And it's been like a routine I've been going through for many years since, because I do live in a war zone. It's not it's not abstract. It's not abstract catastrophes. It's real catastrophes all the time that I have to be alert about. And so I've made a routine, but if I just open my eyes a bit, and you are fearlessly opening your eyes and you come out with these poems, how many poems you've written that talk about dealing with the atrocities that there are, it's just so much strength to write it and then like step back and then to write another one. Just phenomenal.
Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you very much.
When did you write that poem?
Oh, about 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At this point in my life, I really can't remember what in particular was going on, really. You know, now I can, of course, state the pandemic, I can state Ukraine, you know, everything, all of it. Mm-hmm. But I can't remember 10 or 11 years ago what exactly prompted me with that, except that, again, I woke up and thought, oh dear. You know, oh gosh, what, you know, I'm glad to be alive. Is everybody okay? You know, whatever. But yeah, it's just like sort of an ongoing thing. I so respect that you are able to meditate and exercise and handle it that way, because you handle a lot. I mean, a lot, Judy. You just, my God, it seems like, I mean, what I say happens every day really happens every day for you. I observe, you live it. So I so admire that strength and that ability to meditate and to see good. There's coffee in my future, and there's exercise, and there's meditation and the good stuff.
Yeah. I'm taking a meditation course right now, and yesterday's session was about just seeing those microseconds of happiness, just that, and like keeping keeping in your awareness that those microseconds exist and they build up, and sometimes that's enough, if just to keep that light, that inner light attuned.
That's a wonderful thing to remember. And I'm so glad you said that, because that's something I can do. I've tried meditation. I guess I haven't tried it very well, but I've tried meditation. It seems like my monkey mind just goes crazy, and I can't. But what you said about the micro moments, those just little, I can do that. I can say, this is lovely. I'm out here and the weather is good. Or, you know, look at that pretty flower, or look at whatever I'm looking at. I love LA. So, you know, everything around me is to love. So yeah. I can do that.
Yes. And I'm sure your writing is meditation. It doesn't have to be sitting there trying to think of nothing. You know, there's all kinds of meditation.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, let's move on. Your book, Glyphs, which I haven't seen. And in fact, your last book that I asked you to send to me, and you sent it to my mother according to what I asked, I didn't receive, because then we had the pandemic and I never went to Canada to collect that book. So I'm a few books behind. But I'm going to rectify that. We're going to Canada at the end of June, so I'll get to see that book at least. But let's talk about glyphs. Glyphs.
Okay.
I asked in this question about if you made new fans, if new people have come up and like approached you and have started commenting on your poems. And if so, what have they said to you?
Oh, wow. You know, I guess Americans don't like poetry very much, so I'm not a high sale. However, over the last few years, I have gotten some of the loveliest comments and things that I thought nobody'd ever say. There's a poet here in LA, his name is Rick Lupert. He is just marvelous. He's funny and his poetry is good. And he said about after he read Glyphs, he said, reading these poems is like walking through a city's neighborhoods, each neighborhood with its own characteristics. You're on the same walk and you can see the connection as you turn a corner from one poem, page, street to the next, even though the one you've ended up on tells a different story and smells and sounds different. Mm-hmm. And I really love that, because I feel like he gets it, if you know what I mean, yeah. That my poems are the reader and me walking along, having a coffee somewhere, really listening to each other. And that's the important part, is listening to and saying words that must be said. So I love that. And then another really nice thought came from Terry Wolverton, poet whose work I love. And she said, she quotes the poem, she says, "What pulses in us?" asks poet Martina Rees Newberry in her collection Glyphs, with a sensibility reminiscent of Nobel Prize winner Wisława Szymborska. Newberry employs a deceptively controversial poem, but the comparison to Szymborska knocked me out. I just thought, oh my God, you got to be kidding. No. And that just thrilled me to have my name in there with hers.
Yes, that's well done.
Yeah, she's a wonderful poet, and of course, you know, I'm my background's Polish, so you know, we share that.
A very good quote.
Yeah, I was very pleased by that. It's funny. I don't get a lot of fan feedback. But people, when they do say something, they say really lovely things, and I'm awfully happy for that. I'm really happy for that.
To find people who are reading and who are listening. Well, you said to have your words, because you have to say them, to be saying them, to be writing them, and to have someone listen and understand them. Wow.
Right.
That's
great. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think listening is one of those things. I don't know how it is internationally, because I haven't traveled much at all, but it seems like here in America, people don't listen very much. They wait for you to stop talking and answer you. You know what I mean? And so when you find somebody that listens to what you're saying and then thinks a minute to answer you, that's joy to me. Yes. So listening is, I don't know, listening is important to me.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I'm trying to teach my students. We have a rule. When you listen to someone speaking, you listen with an open heart to really try and let their words enter, and maybe you'll learn something new. And that I told them that is such a hard thing to do. I wish adults could do it, but yeah. And it's not just America.
Okay. All right.
It's international. Nobody has patience.
No.
And also people assume they know what you're going to say. So why should they listen?
Yeah, I think that's part of it too. They think they've heard everything. You know, there's nothing new to be said. And there is. Yes. There's always something new.
Yes.
And I've been married to my husband for over 30 years. And for truly, there isn't a day goes by that he doesn't say something new and interesting to me. And it's not because he looks it up in books and then stay. It's just that his mind is always working. And if I listen, I'm always hearing something new or some surprise from him. So listening is really important.
Yeah. Clearly you're listening to your surroundings. That's how you come up with these things, these poems. Number three, is there a poem from Glyphs that you would like to share with us now?
Sure. There's a poem that again includes, you know, reflects my thoughts about the muddle the world's in and all of that. But this is called Dark Feast. Okay. Dark Feast, a banquet, hot dishes of disappointment, cold desserts of rage and revenge. Where shall we eat this dark feast? Forked lightning, small flat stones, shards from broken mirrors. These are utensils. We can only feed ourselves, you know. There are no take-home receptacles to refrigerate, to pack up later in brown bags, to feed the hungry and the homeless. Sunset shows us bruised clouds and a bleeding atmosphere, untrustworthy signs that there will be a tomorrow.
Oh, what a fabulous ending.
Thank you.
It just keeps on resonating. Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I think, you know, as we go through our days, we keep looking, at least I do, we keep looking for signs that there will be a tomorrow. We keep looking for that reassurance every day. You know, yeah, tomorrow's going to come. I know it is, you know. And sometimes the signs don't seem like they're there very much. And yet they are. Yet they are. We wake up, we do the thing, we have our coffee, we talk with a friend. And the signs are there that, yeah, that'll be tomorrow. So.
Part of my ritual is before Gadi and I go to sleep, I say to him, "And do you have any plans for the morning?" And he'll say, "I plan to wake up and maybe there'll be coffee."
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that is. That's enough. That's lovely. I like it. I like that very much. That's great.
Okay, let's move on. Here we have COVID. We're talking about COVID. And do you feel that the barriers have lessened? Have you gone to any personal face-to-face poetry readings? And if not, do you have any favorite podcasts that you've done recently?
Well, I'm still a COVID scaredy cat. Mm. We go out, but always with mask and sanitizer in my bag. Yeah. I still haven't gotten, in better times, we always use buses and subways and stuff. But I am not gone on the buses or the subways, so we walk mostly. And that being said, I haven't scheduled any readings for Glyphs. I'd love to. I'd like to do that. it's let up a bit here that in that there's people are taking off their masks. Mm-hmm. There are poetry readings going on, but like I said, I'm still a scaredy cat, you know. People keep getting it and people keep dying, and I think I don't have it, but I don't want to carry it to anybody, and I'm still a scaredy cat about it. So I don't know what it's going to take to loosen me up entirely, but something. I'll have to hear something better than I hear.
Yeah.
What about you? Do you have experience?
I've been taking trains because I studied Qigong in Tel Aviv, and I've been taking trains, which at the beginning they limited the number of people sitting in a area, and now it's back to normal in terms of population. We don't have to wear masks, but of course I do. And when I'm teaching, the kids stopped wearing masks. I used to have to yell at them, please wear a mask. I'm old. I'm frail. I'm going home to an older man. Think of me. And now they don't. Some of them do, but most of them don't. And I do. And I try to be outside as much as possible when I'm with strangers. But I've had
what you said earlier about everybody's impatient. Nobody has patience. I think this is part of that. People just say, I'm tired of this now. I'm tired of living in a pandemic society. Well, we're all tired of it, but you know, that doesn't make it go away. But I think it's part of that. As you say, people are impatient. They don't have the patience to say, I'm just going to have to live in this way for a while.
Yeah. And many young people can get COVID and it's not a big deal. It's like the flu. And they say, okay, so I'll go to a concert. They go to concerts jammed in shoulder to shoulder. No one's wearing masks.
Yes.
And
yes,
you don't hear about numbers of people getting sick afterwards. So either it's not being reported or it's just a flu. And they say, okay.
Yeah.
But as you said, at our age, we're not interested in finding out what's going to happen. I don't want to get it.
No, I don't either. I don't want it. I don't want to have to go to the hospital. I don't want any of it. So we're really careful.
Yeah, for sure. Just because the headlines say take off your mask doesn't mean that I believe them.
That's it. You know what? Me too. And my husband too. He's really into that. That we, you know, we have got to wear those masks. We have got to carry our sanitizer and make sure that we're not, you know, getting shoulder to shoulder with people. If we do eat out or go out, it's all outside cafes. I mean, and we don't go out very much, but if we do, we usually try to do it early in the day and when nobody's there and outside.
Yeah.
So,
so similar. So we've never gone out. So it's not like we gave anything up.
We
walk, we're in nature. And when I teach, that's my most social, or when I get on a train or a bus. But in general, it's a basic distrust of the population.
Yes.
And trying to deal with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 6 in this list of questions. Do you ever dream of an alternate self able to write completely different work? Or do you fantasize being able to express something in a way so unlike the voice you've nurtured? A secret, Martina.
I would love to be a novelist. I love fiction and I just get buried in stories. My alternate self would write clean, beautiful lines like Hemingway, wonderful, accessible stories like Steinbeck, gripping scenes like Donna Tartt and Shirley Jackson. Amazing emotional rise like F. Scott Fitzgerald. I'd be a mixture of those people and writing things that, I don't even care about the bestseller list, but just writing things that people say, I got to get that book. I've got to get it. So yeah, I would like to be a novelist. I wrote early on, just way back when, I wrote a book of short stories and a novel. And at that time, long time ago, at that time, I had an agent And I had written a nonfiction book, and had they picked it up and they published it, and, wow. and I had this agent, but he could that guy. I mean, God bless my. I had two, and they couldn't sell it. They couldn't sell my novels for anything. Nobody was interested. So I was always writing poetry, and so I thought, you know, I think maybe I'll just go back to what I know. But if I could be something else, I'd be a novelist.
Do you feel you have stories in you that want to come out?
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, I do. But you know, when I think about them and think about writing them, they seem silly to me. The ideas seem like, you know, well, that's a little, you know, that's kind of dopey. That's kind of silly. Sometimes I think of stories like Philip K. Dick writes. I think about those kinds of stories. But if I start to put down notes or I think I'm going to write something, it just comes out to where I'm not enjoying it. And it's just like a struggle and it's silly. So I just stick with what I do.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Okay. You do so much. You do so many things. Do you still make puppets?
I've sort of shied away from going into my puppet room. Ah, by the way, it sounds like this meeting might end. If so, we've got just got to click on the same link that we clicked on originally.
Okay.
And we'll get back in. Oh, somebody told me there's no time limit when there's just two people, but we'll see.
Okay.
Anyway, I found a mouse in my puppet shack, and I said to myself, that mouse might have lived here for years, but I had never noticed, and maybe not, because I have a face that's waiting to be filled, and anything I can sew by hand, I bring into the house, not in the puppet shack, and I sew by hand, mm-hmm. But then I take my puppets to school and I find that the kids have been ruining my puppets. Suddenly there's a hole in the cheek or the lips have to be re-glued. And I'm feeling very squeamish about actually using them.
But there you go.
Bring them for therapy. I have a few puppets that I bring for therapy with older kids, and they express empathy with these puppets. And that's brilliant.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
Yeah, that's
wonderful. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and the kids enjoy it. But
I bet they do.
I started to write memoirs of when I left the kibbutz to live with a jazz band. I started to write down those stories because there's a bunch of interesting stories, and I don't know if it'll become something or anything, but it's very enjoyable to go back and recreate these bizarre characters who live together in a communal way.
And that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so I've started, and I work sort of remotely with Tamara. She and I were sort of finding a convenient time, and we used an audio app on a phone to sort of know that we were breathing. We could hear each other breathing. You know, we would work on our documents. So that was very wonderful for a while. And I kept on going, even though she and I stopped meeting that way. And it's interesting. So there's that. But it's not fiction. I don't have any fiction up my sleeve. That seems, I'd love to be able to do it.
So do I, yeah.
Okay, seven. Ah, right. You inspire me because you write every day. Come what may. And I go through spurts where that's possible. And then I'm forced to leave the house and the writing gets put aside for a bit, like what's happening with me with these memoirs. But I would like to know about your writing space. Is there sunlight, a view, a favorite drink, a timer, a cushion? Or do you have a ritual that you follow? Could you share details about where you write?
Well, I do follow a ritual. I'm nowhere as busy and productive as you are, Judy. So on so many levels. So it's not difficult for me to have the time to write. When I was younger and working outside the home, I got up about 4:30 a.m. to have a couple of hours before getting ready for work. Mm-hmm. And now I get up about 7 and I go immediately to my desk. My husband makes coffee and kindly brings me a cup. Almost always I read something to get started, to get my brain going, a poem by a favorite poet, a paragraph from a novel or an essay. I look at the previous day's work and see if it needs editing or if I still like it. Mm-hmm. Very often I have notes that I took when I was reading something. Mm-hmm. Or listening to something or watching something. And I look at those notes and begin trying to find a poem in them. I stay at it even when the end product is dreadful, which it sometimes is. I mean, that's just the way it goes. I try to stay at my desk until 4. Wow. Which is 4 p.m., which is when I'll have a glass of wine or a martini or a soda or something, and then I close up shop for the day then.
Mm-hmm. So that's like a full working day. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep at that real regularly. I think I'm almost, I don't want to say afraid, but it makes me easy to walk away from the ritual, to not do it. It makes me, yeah, uneasy, and I sort of feel like, you know, what if I can't ever do it again? Or, yeah, I don't know, but it just makes me uneasy not to do that.
I totally understand. I'm the same way with my rituals. Fear keeps me doing it every day.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a real... I guess it is. It is fair. It's just that, you know, if I don't do it today, well, I don't, then what about tomorrow? Will I not do it tomorrow? Or what if I wake up Wednesday and I can't do it or whatever? So yeah, my rituals are super important.
Right. I so relate to that. Okay. Number 8, let's get into something easy. What do you think is the most pressing issue of the day as a society?
I think that there are so many issues all rolled up into one big scary ball that feels like it's leading to something apocalyptic. Constant wars, disrespect for the planet, despotism, new diseases, all the things that continue to keep us strangers to each other. I'm not ashamed of being terrified a good deal of the time, nor of sometimes losing hope. I do sometimes. The pressing issues are always there, and they feel to me like they're getting worse instead of better, or that I'm feeling them more than I ever did. I'm not sure which it is, but everything just seems to be building to some sort of apocalyptic mess, you know, it's hard sometimes, I don't know, at low points or just when I'm feeling down or tired or something, it's hard not to see all these things balling up like a big ball of yarn, you know, and where is that going to take us? Where's it end, you know? So yeah, I think the most pressing issue is that we're just absolutely bombarded with all these negative things all the time, every day. If they're not happening to us personally, they're happening to our neighbor or to somebody in another country. It just seems like it's just rolling. And that's, to me, the most pressing issue is just that bombardment, I don't watch the news either, by the way. I've tried to distance myself from that for the last few years. But even with that, it just feels so ongoing. And I feel like if there was some way to stop that bombardment of negativity, that maybe we could get back on track somehow.
So you
Does
feel
that make that, sense?
Yeah, totally. You're feeling that it's not personal. You're feeling that the whole world is caught up in this endless yarn of negativity. And there's no end even to say, here's the end of the yarn and let's unravel it.
Yes, that's exactly. You say it better than me. Yes.
No, I'm just
Yeah,
saying.
that's absolutely what I mean.
Wow. And there's something about also the fact that you and I are, well, everyone is aging, and we very much doubt that we're going to see a solution if by the end of our lifetime, it's nothing is getting
Yeah.
better.
Right. It's like, I'm toward, I'm in the latter part of my life. And the earlier part of my life, I could always say, well, in 10 years, it'll be different. In 20 years, it'll probably be different. Or they'll solve this in 15 years, I bet.
You're listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plans Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
We're back recording. Here we go. I
That
don't know what
wasn't so
happened.
hard.
That wasn't so hard.
No, that wasn't too bad. It just took a while. I got a message. It said the meeting is ending in 33 seconds, and then boom, it was gone. So,
Okay, we were talking about
okay.
that ball
We were
of
talking
yarn of
about
negativity, and
yarn
now
of
it feels
negativity.
like a great big
Yeah.
calf could just come along and scoop it away.
Yeah. I'm ready for somebody to knit it into something worthwhile.
Yeah, a blanket and just cover us and say
Yeah,
it'll be okay.
everything's gonna be all right.
Do you know how they knit or crochet?
No,
No, me too.
I don't. But I've often thought I'd like to learn. I know that they have ones on YouTube, that'll teach you how. And I've always thought it'd be a fun thing to do. Do you do all that?
No. When I belong to the Girl
No.
Guides to get a badge, we had to knit a square. I was so nervous. This baby pink yarn, by the time I finished my, God knows what shape it was gray with my sweat and my nerves. And no.
I know, it's crazy. You know what? My mom was this fantastic artisan. She could do everything. So sculpt, paint, anything she could do it.
Wow.
And she tried that, God bless her, she tried so hard to teach me to sew. And I took homemaking, of course, in school, like girls did. And I could not learn to sew a stitch. I mean, it was just impossible. I'd break needles. I couldn't thread them. I couldn't do the pattern thing right. I ended up in homemaking, making this apron, and brought it home to my mom. And I could just tell by the way she looked at it that it was not a suitable apron. So I'm not good at any of that stuff.
No. Okay. No problem. Everyone's got their own thing. I like sewing because it's
Yeah.
calming, but knitting for me, it's just one challenge too much. Okay. Let's get back to writing, talking about poetry.
Okay.
Question nine. Do you think that your attitude has changed this past while? Do you find yourself longing more or less for others' society? Do you gravitate to different places on your walks? Do you ever imagine about being somewhere else for an extended period, alone or with your beloved?
My beloved, I love that word. That's great. My beloved and I sometimes think about living somewhere else, like Scotland, or that's his background is Scots, and we sort of fantasize about living there in the UK. It's a fun fantasy. Walks, we like to take the same paths generally. There are outside cafes and markets that are habitual to us, in places along the way that we just like to sit and think for a little while. As you know, I'm passionately in love with my city, Los Angeles, and I just sort of sit somewhere and hug her sometimes in my head. Like you, I've always been a bit of a loner. So I don't go to many gatherings or anything like that. I'm awfully shy, except with family. Luckily, my beloved is the same about most of that, except for the shy thing. He is not shy by any means. He's out and about and talks to anybody. I've experienced three residencies at writers' retreats, and I wrote well there because they have an absolute thing about silence and leaving people alone and stuff. But I have my own little writing retreat here now, and so I don't think I need to retreat again anywhere.
Yeah. At the beginning of the pandemic, I would binge watch those shows where people look for properties in the countryside of England.
Yes, that's a good show.
Loved it. Loved it. And I would just, I was starving to see those green spaces and people. It wasn't shot during the pandemic. It was way before, and they were maskless and these luscious hills and expanses of countryside. And they just had to choose which amazing stone house they would take.
Yeah. Those wonderful houses. Oh, they're out of fairy tale books. I just love them.
Yeah, exactly. And the thought of not exactly living in one, but just going with, watching with them was enough.
I know. Just looking around, it'd be so great. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Finally, we're getting to the end of this. Is there anything you'd like to add or something you'd like to be on record? This will be in the audio.
I'd like to read this poem from Glyphs. Okay. It embraces my everyday hopes and wishes. It's called Deference.
Okay.
Today, I will look for astonishment, damned if I won't. I'll show deference to all the gods, the huge great gods with the old familiar names, and the insignificant gods I tend to ignore. God of termites, God of rattlesnakes, God of hives, God of the common cold, God of dog poop on my heel, God of high utility bills, God of stubbed toes and bad hair days. I'll walk my favorite circle around this wonderful fallen city and will understand why I lived to get to this day. I will invent a new language of praise today, mindful that life is never in remission. I'll walk my city without one prayer to those huge gods for a miracle anti-wrinkle cream that only costs $5 or the loss of 10 pounds more. I'll invent new words for thank you for my eyesight. And if tempted to relapse, I will look at the world through the tiny holes in a button, and through there, I'll see all that is necessary.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Thank you.
Holes through a button.
Well, that's what you were talking about, those minuscule moments.
Yes, and there you put it in a button. That's brilliant.
Well, thank you. So much. You're wonderful. You're wonderful. You know, I start my every single day with your wonderful haiku. Wow. I just love them. And I start every day with them. I read them every single day. Your haikus, they just start my heart every morning. Oh, I love them. And I read them as soon as I get up, as soon as I go to my desk, I read them because they just start my soul working, and I love them. You are so talented and so skilled on so many levels, but your poetry is just amazing.
Well, thank you so much, because as you probably know, I consider it a practice. I don't consider it an art. I'm just trying to replicate what I experienced in that moment, and it's just practicing.
You know, the world is a better place because of you.
Oh.
Because you're in it. Really. The world is a better place because you're in it. Never forget that.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, my darling.
I can't say that's true of everybody, but it's true of you.
Wow. Well, you know what I think of you.
I know. You're wonderful, and you're my dear friend, and if the fates don't put us together personally and physically why we're always together in my heart.
Yeah, that's true. I just read your poem. I hear your voice. And it's good to know that you exist, holding up the world on your shoulders for a bit.
You too. You too. That's just how I think about you.
You are listening to Spirit World Restless with DJ Judy on Spirit Plans Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
I'm Judy Weinstein, and I'm reading to you today from Kibbutz Nir Oz in the western Negev of Israel. Cartography 101. When I turned a lined page in my notebook, I realized that this blank paper is for you, for me to call attention to your maps and models and musings so vital to me, that without them, without you, this spinning sphere would slow, falter, stop completely, and I would fall off it to become part of a bits and pieces universe.
Ace Bogus from Charleston, West Virginia. Phases of the moon. There is no man or woman in the moon, but we become the moon and end up appraising ourselves, all reflections of ourselves in lakes and ponds and on the surface of well water. We walk on the grass on a June morning, say in Vermont or Maine or North Carolina, and the drops of the previous night's rain lay large as an owl's eyes. On the green blades, we see ourselves, and what we see there, or anywhere for that matter, wants more than anything to be whole, fully understood, fully desired.
This is a Bantam View out of Western Pennsylvania reading Street Scene. They told us to open the doors, to slide back the iron gates. They said, look out. See the sleepy children playing with their hungry toys. See the old men and women walking the sidewalks with tremendous slowness. Their ancient eye sockets have seen too much. They told us to open the sliding gates and go down the frozen steps. They wanted us to see the monsters of loneliness, the unconscious souls. They wanted us to know the great silence of that city. We stood on the steps and watched the street. The demons which had lived only in our dreams were all there, and we knew real fear. We huddled at the top of the stairs. The demons motioned us to come. Come on, they said. You wooed and won their master, from your desires to his power. He is one of you.
Hey, Jimmy Heffernan here. Slouched against the stair rail. Forget everything you think you know about the homeless folks in this city, of celestial beings and divine messengers. Let's see if I can recreate for you the image of that strange old man at the Red Line station on Wilshire and Western. Slouched against the stair rail and wearing black pants and a purple sport coat. Close your eyes and you will see him there. Purple coat, shabby black pants, grimy mismatched socks, holy sneakers. Got a cigarette? Yes. I offer from a pack of ovals. He smiles at one toothy smile, then look. He takes a cigarette holder from his pocket and inserts my offering. Waits for my lighter. Now, think on this. A homeless dude holding that ciggy aloft in a somewhat elegant holder and waving me off. He said, merci pour la cigarette. Je vous remercie de votre beauté et de votre générosité. C'était mon anniversaire hier et tous les oiseaux semblaient le savoir. Imagine saying goodbye in French and him homeless. Imagine.
Hi, this is Raymond Soulier Jr. in Milk Gross, Massachusetts. Cartography 101. When I turned the line page in my notebook, I realized that this blank paper is for you, for me to call attention to your maps and models and musing so vital to me, that without them, Without you, this spinning sphere would slow, falter, stop completely, and I would fall off it to become part of a bits and pieces universe.
Samnot, getting ready. Watch for the tint of rain-weathered skies, blue-gray clouds. Doubtless, they'll watch for you. Make yourself ready for the rush, when both will meet and hand your observation to you in wanton sheets of wet. Dig your toes into the damp earth, wait to be kissed by grey weather, wind that whistles, whips your hair, forbids you to rest or sing or count your coins. Tired. Same questions. Their answers worn and dragged underfoot. Rain voice says, straighten up. And you will. You do as it says. You know that rain, with its discomforts and untimely absurdities and such, is all that's left that will not lie.
Hello, this is Joe Magic, Joe Money, Joe Monet. Gibbous moon. It is so dark. Clouds must be covering up the stars. Yes, I'm certain that's the reason for it. There is only a slash, a ladle of light from the waxing gibbous moon. It is the time of pornography, regret, terror, and other secrets. Although sexual fantasies can present themselves at any time, and dark seems to equal covert. But it's the dark that seems to promise the most faithful intimacies. As a youngster, I loved secrets, the eternal ritual of secrets, bending close to hear them, the familiarity, the confidence given. That no one would ever know what I just heard, the confidence from the whisperer, that I would never tell anyone, or maybe that I would tell, if that was the goal. Now I am older and don't like the unrevealed as much as I once did. The unwanted pregnancy, the torrid love affair. I can no longer keep track of secrets. I no longer see their importance, their urgency for me or the whisperer. The places in my soul where I kept secrets are taken up with anxiety in regards to my own mortality. The dark is that place where I search every corner for my wrongdoings. Where, often on my knees, I beg forgiveness from you who read this, from the moon, from Jesus, from my dead parents, from every waxing and waning moon. In noche me, I pray, fiat mihi in aeternum vive. Forgive me, let me live forever.
Hello, this is Cassie Soulard. Meaning of magic. I ought to learn more about omens' importance. There are those who live by them, in the center of them, every decision designed in the light of dire actions. There is so much to memorize if I desire immortality. Never toast anyone with water unless you want them to die. Never stick your chopsticks straight up, which looks like incense sticks at a funeral. Never whistle indoors, which summons death and demonic spirits. Never put your shoes on a table. It symbolizes the death of a loved one. Never cut your nails at night. It causes premature death, as does seeing a crow, sleeping in a room with a fan running, walking under a ladder, or inviting an owl into your home. Well, an owl being there with or without an invitation. We demand life, see it as our right, and, still, some wrap their existence in the sorcery of signs and superstitions. In the mysteries of flesh, the magic that is the body, we entertain a terrible, insatiable hunger to control and direct every envelopment, every emanation. In the end, we claim to love and respect divine superintendence, that very omnipresence which makes magic meaningless, Gift Wraps Us presents us to the unknown.
Hello, this is Nathan Horowitz.
Coded sounds. In the same way we put an ear to the wall or a door or the window to hear a conversation not really meant for us, we listen to the rivulets of water sliding over rocks or hailstones hitting sidewalks and trash can lids. We listen for the secrets they are telling the earth. While they are surely not meant for us, the sounds are so proliferate, we can listen without guilt. The roads are drenched in dreams and ciphers. Birdsong gives way to mystery, song, and mud song. I tell the sky, be careful what you say. Somebody is always listening.
Hello, everybody. This is Tamara Miles from Elgin, South Carolina. Postscript. The eyes of our souls are always looking down, watching for what might bring us to harm. The magic of being like ice sculptures until touched never leaves us once it is discovered. We have been traded for money, for food, for rowboats, for sweets, and for belief in Christ himself. Indecently strong, still easily bought by praise, our lips search our steps, find flowers and fire and magic. We are, after all, the magician's lovely assistants, aren't we? With one hypnotic gesture from their wands, they create you and that which you think you own.
Gregory Kelly in England. Cartography 101. When I turned the lined page in my notebook, I realized that this blank paper is for you. From me to call attention to your maps and models and musings so vital to me that, without them, without you, this spinning sphere would slow, falter, stop completely. And I would fall off it to become part of a bits and pieces universe.
Phases of the moon. There is no man or woman in the moon, but we become the moon and end up appraising ourselves, all reflections of ourselves in lakes and ponds and on the surface of well water. When we walk on the grass on a June morning, say in Vermont or Maine or North Carolina, and the drops of the previous night's rain lay large as an owl's eyes on the green blades, we see ourselves in what we see there, or anywhere for that matter, wants more than anything to be whole, fully understood, fully desired.
Everything. I found a letter I had begun to write to you, dear girl, and never finished. It was written before there was email, and endless writing spaces I wrote to you while in a staff meeting at the college where I worked. In it, I said everything. Told you about a man's wrinkled collar right in front of me, another man's worn coat cuff, a woman two rows down holding up a stiff back and attentive posture, how I knew her and that she was bleeding inside from a carved up heart. I told you about my tight shoes and my failed diet, and about fear pulling the blankets off the night before, leaving me too open and too cold. I wrote about our dry yard, my children's school, my wish to run away. I said I missed you, wished I could come there and live near you. All this was written on wheat-colored paper, folded into a small square and hidden in the toe of a wheat-colored sock. I never mailed it, and I don't know why. Now I want you to have this letter to remember that once we wrote everything to each other.
We wrote until all our writing paper was gone, and we wrote on napkins, receipts, and cigarette papers, and on purloined memo pads, and on the back of the odd photograph. We wrote until we had to use blood or spit for ink. Yes, here at last is your letter. It is arriving late, very late in our lives, and it is still everything.
The title disruption event named Assassin-14-LI. Assassin-14-LI was a title disruption. A star wandering too close to a 3 million solar mass black hole was torn apart. The debris gathered into an accretion disk around the black hole. Data from NASA's Swift satellite showed that the initial formation of the disk was shaped by interactions among incoming and outgoing streams of tidal debris. Some excursive, no-name star believed that space was unlimited. It must have been terribly young, achingly lovely, somewhat irresponsible, as young things so often are, or maybe choked up on atomic and molecular gas. I'm certain that Ms. Mr. No-Name Star saw the future and journeyed on, despite what the future held, headed straight for that black, impoverished pool of whatever it is a pool of, and was devoured, torn apart as if by cosmic wolves. I can't help but be reminded of Coleridge, who saw the future of the world and bent words toward that future. He once took a ship to Malta and back, and on shore watched silently as crows took over the branches of a tree, daring him to do something about it. Word has it that he went quite willingly to his death from some no-name lung ailment which came about because he so loved opium. The tragically destroyed star would have presumed all of this. Stars understand everything.
Initial. A well-known someone once wrote a poem for me. To my delight, it showed up in a literary journal of some repute, and then in an actual book. My initials were there, right under the title and following the word for. I was delighted that this fine poet had discovered words meant especially for me. And I hadn't even slept with him or chatted him up flirtatiously. My friends, I ask you to imagine it, a poem for me, who ground away at her own poems, hustling the hell out of every line, always afraid that my lack of credentials would become oh so apparent in my ignorance of literary intricacies. I must tell you, that poem didn't care one bit about my lack of formal education. It mentioned beauty and had an understanding inside it that claimed the right to know what beauty is and what it is worth. It doesn't matter that you aren't beautiful, my father said. It matters whether or not you're smart. He, too, had discovered words just for me. This all happened years ago. The poem with my initials happened 35 years ago, when I remember or dream, I forget which. It is those initials I see, for those initials are what I believe.
Seeing. I read a story in a book about trees and leaves and moss and such, which told of small lives below Earth's surface. Just around root and ring were these lives, each holding on to the magic of quiet and concealment. And the story said, if you sat under the trees, cleared a small circle of leaves, and sat inside it, your back braced against the tree trunk, you would feel the small lives pulsating. Feel the blinks of tiny, seeing eyes boring through their ceiling, which, as I have told you, is the Earth's crust. And if you are lucky enough to have with you a child or a lover, and if you pull the silence up under your chin like a quilt, you can sleep and dream the dreams of kings and queens and claim the gifts of gods.
Romance novel. During the last rapture, I was reading a romance novel. When the storm's eye ignited the calm with wind and with salt, with the scent of herbs and earth, I heard it all. On the page, it was 14th century Scotland. Adaria was kidnapped by Herne as revenge for losses in battle, while Anthea and Rhiannon's baby was born in their kitchen, born with a caul, which the midwife removed and buried under a tree near their icy creek. I had only to turn another page when there were sheets of hail on the roof. Lights failed for a minute or two while I waited for the voice of God to call me up and hold me accountable. I felt sure I would be chosen, that you, dearest, would be too. I waited, shifted in the chair, began another chapter when the lights came back on. It had been a short rapture this time, and once again I was not taken. With the surge of years, I've seen the world undone more times than there are numbers. Everyone asks everyone, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" And the answer is always, "Fine, thank you. Just fine." No one asks if all things beautiful now plead for violence. Are we easily appeased by victims and agonies? At night, the stars steam and roil. The sky is threatened by cataracts of fire, clouds of venom. A new rapture, a new novel. On the page, a ship sinks in a storm in 1845, Australia. Oliver, Ruby, and Ava are the only survivors. They are beautiful, while the island on which they are stranded is not. Oh yes, and there is a mystery presence, something looming. The news this morning is that we are winning the fight against terrorism. The security situation in Afghanistan is getting worse. We bomb Libya to free its citizens. All raptures are the final raptures. And again, dearest, we are not.
The glyphs in the canyons. I've forgotten those times between wakefulness and dozing and sleep. I know something happened, but I can't recall what it was. It's like trying to recall where I was just before I was born. My friend tells me that this is the reason I should never fear death. She says, "You don't know where you were before you were born, so why fret about where you'll be after you die?" This is wisdom I can acknowledge, but from which I glean no comfort, and it is comfort I want more than nearly anything. I want the great eyes of God to turn my tears to opals, and the great tongue of God to tell me that life and death are the same, that I will keep loving and making love, and walking and humming, and wanting and holding, and will never lose my appetite for joy or for potato chips and onion dip and ice cream. Between wakefulness and dozing and sleeping, what is there to know? Who do I serve awake, asleep? Who do I honour when I doze? And why is wakefulness the stain on all this embalmed paradise?
Cartography 101. When I turned the lined page in my notebook, I realized that this blank paper is for you. For me to call attention to your maps and models and musings so vital to me. That without them, without you, this spinning sphere would slow, falter, stop completely. And I would fall off it. To become part of a bits and pieces universe.
Phases of the moon. There is no man or woman in the moon, but we become the moon and end up appraising ourselves, all reflections of ourselves, in lakes and ponds and on the surface of well water. When we walk on the grass on a June morning, say in Vermont or Maine or North Carolina, and the drops of the previous night's rain lay large as an owl's eyes On the green blades, we see ourselves and what we see there, or anywhere for that matter, wants more than anything to be whole, fully understood, fully desired.
That hour. The hour between dog and wolf is ripe with trepidation. Some say it's from the light's unwillingness to give up, give in. Others say there is an odor to twilight, something sickly sweet, vegetable and animal together in a dank potpourri. It's the hour of the unfinished phrase, the hair undone, the photo not taken, the canvas empty, clean paintbrushes at the easels. If clouds are going to mass, they will do so at dusk. If the wind picks up, it does so at owl's light. All things bend, twirl, slow, and stop at cocklight to wait for dark and its regime of rest.
Secrets. What the stiff breeze and the ocean have to say remains a mystery. Who are we to try to understand the splinters of a broken boat that strays onto the beach? Or suppose the sleeve from a small jacket ends up on some jutting rocks. What are we to glean from that? Then there are the grasses that nearly reach the waterline but never quite get there. The necklace chain, the watch face, the scrap of lingerie in those grasses must be some kind of prophecy or an omen. But what kind? A few nights ago, I dreamed of Polly's Island. The water was so warm there in the Atlantic Sea that it unsettled me, and I wondered if I was actually asleep. Then a house nearby caught on fire, and the ocean, understanding the urgency, rose up, put the fire out. The silence was profound, and the only sound to be heard in the dreamscape was a far-off bell on a buoy, tinging out the riddles only the seaweed understands.
Seeing. I read a story in a book about trees and leaves and moss and such, which told of small lives below Earth's surface. Just around root and ring were these lives, each holding on to the magic of quiet and concealment. And the story said, if you sat under the trees, cleared a small circle of leaves and sat inside it, your back braced against the tree trunk, you would feel the small lives pulsating, feel the blinks of tiny seeing eyes boring through their ceiling, which, as I have told you, is the Earth's crust. And if you are lucky enough to have with you a child or a lover, and if you pull the silence up under your chin like a quilt, you can sleep and dream the dreams of kings and queens and claim the gifts of gods.
Sadie and the Sea. Sadie tells me she has had sex with the ocean. She says that it began with a wave which came up behind her, and a door in that wave swung open. At first, she says, she was afraid, but went anyway, deep into the doorway, into a room of blue, green, wet, and salt, and whispers from a bed of sand. She was stroked and lightly sanded, and the water enveloped and entered her with a tenderness reserved for its frailest creatures. She was, after that, she tells me, a nympho on the half shell, shameless in the face of foam and tides. Sex with the ocean, said Sadie, is similar to sex with angels, which I have had on numerous occasions. Although, to be perfectly honest, angels are heavier than the ocean, more cumbersome, more insistent, more intrusive, not as slick, not as salty. In the past, I've found Sadie's stories difficult to hear. She tortures her days with truth, the straight stuff, and I prefer my reality peppered with at least a few fictional embellishments. That being said, my late night dreams explode with this particular tale's implications. What to say except, good night, Sadie. Good night.
Residue. I'd like to leave a residue of sensuality, fluency. I'd like to leave expressions like dance moves to flood the faces of those I've loved. For you, I'd like to leave a perfect gesture and the physical memory of a kiss that was like no other, and a touch that encourages the mind to turn toward dreams of Everest. For you, I want magenta memories that give porn films their comeuppance and flavors your visions of us and we. I want the conscripted memories to fall away as if they had the torque of 1,000 rockets. I want you to continue to say the mumblings of your heart. Stay where you are. Let the trees give back breath to the sky. Let the trunks believe they are tent poles keeping the stars above us where they belong.
Welcome, Matt. If you want to live, there is still room for you here. We ask only a few things of you, though they are huge things. First, it is necessary to begin each of your days with a consideration of the sun's radiance. If there is no sun, a 40-watt light bulb will do. Next, we ask that you sort out your resources, alphabetize them, and lay them in rows on top of your dresser. Next, you must fix what is broken. Erase all graffiti from walls, unless it is sexual in nature, and plunge the toilets in your building with great vigor. Last, certainly not least, you must consider 2 lost loves each day. You must learn the language of aspen trees, and allow all you own to experience a miracle. The last thing I'll say to you is not one of the commandments. It is a suggestion. If you want to find wholeness or peace, you may not have both. In this life, you must walk into the world, look for an idol in a cow pasture, and worship it.
Phases of the moon. There is no man or woman in the moon, but we become the moon and end up appraising ourselves, all reflections of ourselves, in lakes and ponds and on the surface of well water. When we walk on the grass on a June morning, say in Vermont or Maine or North Carolina, and the drops of the previous night's rain lay large as an owl's eyes, on the green blades. We see ourselves, and what we see there, or anywhere for that matter, wants more than anything to be whole, fully understood, fully desired.
Seeing. I read a story in a book about trees and leaves and moss and such, which told of small lives below Earth's surface, just around root and ring were these lives, each holding on to the magic of quiet and concealment. And the story said, if you sat under the trees, cleared a small circle of leaves and sat inside it, your back braced against a tree trunk, you would feel the small lives pulsating, feel the blinks of tiny seeing eyes boring through their ceiling, which, as I have told you, is the Earth's crust. And if you are lucky enough to have with you a child or a lover, and if you pull the silence up under your chin like a quilt, you can sleep and dream the dreams of kings and queens and claim the gifts of gods.
And I want to thank you for listening.